Day 7 of the November 03 7-day retreat in Springwater. I hope you're not too disappointed that there will not be any reading, if you've looked forward to it. And yet there are also some people who may prefer a talk, because I've heard it say, I wouldn't leave early on Saturday if you gave another talk. So we'll debate this whole matter sometime in staff meeting maybe. Today we will talk about a topic that came up in one of the very first group meetings, and as it came up, it sort of made its way through all the people. I don't think there was anyone who was not participating in that particular topic, and that was how to deal with the loss of a loved one, a partner, a spouse, a friend, maybe a dog or a cat. I didn't say it right then, but it comes to mind right now that famous story of a woman in ancient India at the time of the Buddha, who had lost her only son and was inconsolable over that loss. Totally devastated, she could not bear the thought of burying him or burning him. So she carried him around on her back and then heard about this sage who was in the vicinity holding meetings, giving talks, and she decided to go there. She went up to the Buddha and asked him for help. Could he do something for her, maybe bring that child back to life? And the Buddha asked her to go around the village, not leave out any house, knock on each door and ask the people who were living there whether anyone had died, and to bring him a mustard seed for everyone who had had no loss of death in their family. And she did as she was asked, and she did go from house to house, and she returned empty-handed. With that, she buried her son and joined the Buddha's order. Now, it seems nowadays, or maybe in other times too, it is for many people not a consolation to know and be told that everybody has to die and everybody has to experience the pain of loss. This doesn't strike deep enough at what we're going through with the loss of someone we deeply loved, were deeply attached to, lived in great harmony with. What consolation can there come through words? Of course, remembering myself at the moment that Kyle died, this intense grief at the moment seemed to ask of the brain or the imagination to tell that we would see each other again. There was this real urge to go into some of those stories of meeting again together at another place. It was just a brief flickering. And interestingly enough, and there was a recognition that this was living in imagination. And the brain lit up on that attempt of consolation. There was here to my left a dead Kyle. It was not Kyle anymore. That was so clear. It was a dead human being. No more what there had been. And a refusal of the brain and maybe the wisdom of being to spin out a story of a later reunion. This was not an intentional decision. It worked out of the wisdom of presence. Rather be with the real of what was happening and what was going on than to slip into the solace of a story, by which I do not want to put down people or stories of afterlife. This is up to each one. But here, it just simply didn't work. And there was no way of getting out of the grief. If one has lived together, in our case it was some 50 years, for other people it is shorter, it doesn't matter. If there has been a real union of energy and affection and harmony working together with all the difficulties that are woven into that fabric, one has gone through difficulties together. This is very important. Then the loss is a fracture. A fracturing of the common field of energy that one has shared. I used to call it felt like an amputation. Something that was part of one was gone. And with that, there is inevitable pain and sorrow and grief and longing. It's unavoidable if one is willing to face the situation as it presents itself. Of course, everything reminds one of the one one loved. Everything, particularly if one has shared a house together, there isn't a corner, there isn't an object, a view that one hasn't shared and enjoyed together. And since there are so many things, there are so many griefs in the course of a day and night, twinges, stabs with a lot of pain. It's actually interesting that this is coming up because it's a few days before Kyle's death day 4 years ago. And in contrast to other mornings, every morning when I wake up, there's the assumption that he's there. And there has to be a coming to that he's not there. This is not connected with a lot of grief anymore, but a little shock that something that was so taken for granted has finished. It's come to an end. And many people were very interested whether I could feel Kyle's presence around me. I'd heard stories about this for a long time also at the Zen Center. Somebody told me when his mother died, he felt her presence everywhere. I didn't. I only felt thoughts and their accompanying pain and sadness and grief. But there was no such perception of a presence. Kyle was dead. There was no doubt about it. So, how does one deal with it? How to come to terms with this? And this is everybody's own affair. I find no fault with anybody's ways of dealing with it. And if the grief is too heavy, too strong, too intense to bear it, then there will be a pushing aside, a repressing of this whole thing. So that people at times tell me in a retreat, I'm only now beginning to feel that grief that I never felt when I lost my father or my son or my mother. This is not true for me. It has not ever been repressed. But something else eventually took place. And I'm not saying this to tell my story, but to see whether maybe hearing it and relating to it may be of some help. Maybe not. I'm telling it because the question arose for many people. It was really alive in that group. The aliveness of dying. The grief of dying. Or having lost someone. Although there were very heavy moments for Kyle. I told you one where he had all of a sudden this overwhelming despair that he had never achieved anything in his life. Had he used his life properly? This kind of stuff we've talked about here. And all I could say was sort of bend down to him, put my head on his chest and say, Kyle, you're here. You're here. And like magic, his despair dissipated. There was the heaving and motion abated. He was calm. And then he held a very beautiful talk when people from staff came over. He wanted them to come over. He said, let's have a breakfast. And a couple people were fixing. Oh, he wanted pancakes. Pancakes and maple syrup. And then people were gathered around him, the friends from the center. And he thanked them for all they had done for him. And this came out of a lot of confused mind, lack of lucidity, and fantasizing or sometimes hallucinating things. But all of a sudden, there was this moment of clarity. Those who were there will remember it. And he said, don't worry about me anymore, after he had thanked everyone for what they had done. Don't worry about me anymore. Take care of Tony. I could almost cry when I say that. At a certain element of sentimentality. Take care of her. Follow her, he said, which was, I couldn't believe that he would say that. He was a strong adherent of Krishnamurti's teaching, but he said that, whatever was in his mind. And then he said very sweetly, and don't hurt her. We'd gone through a lot of stuff that happens when you're engaged in this work with staff and people, and at times rebellious people, because we had left in what some people thought was a rebellion, which it was not. But then this rebelliousness had to go someplace. we had left now. We were on our own, and so sometimes it was directed at me. And it was very, very wonderful at that time to have Kyle around to talk to, and he had a real deep wisdom. One time he said, when I was so worried, what would they think and what would they say? He said, don't think you can cover all your bases. And I wasn't too familiar with baseball, but I got a feeling for what he meant. Don't worry. Just be with what's up and don't worry about what is happening elsewhere. Sometimes, and people have asked this, can't words help us at times? And remembering this, or remembering his saying, when you give money to your child, kiss it goodbye. We talked about that in the group. At the time you're about not to kiss it goodbye, or not to cover your bases, or want to have your bases covered, and a sentence like that comes up, it sort of interrupts that train of thought. It sort of shatters it. And with that comes a freedom from this thought process. So as I said, in the beginning, and that lasted, I would say, at least a year and a half, this thing of every thought causing pain and grief and longing. Particular words like never, ever again. Very, very dangerous words to say to oneself. I will never see him again. We will never do this again. I learned the hard way that to abstain from such words, because they just arouse a wave of grief and sadness and longing and so forth. Whereas if this word with its wake is interrupted, one can go unscathed by ever fresh paining emotions. But it was not easy in the beginning. It didn't work most of the time. Until it became possible, not through willpower, but it is this amazing inbuilt wisdom of attention and awareness and presence, to see a quote-unquote dangerous thought arise, see the danger of it, in this case the danger of getting enveloped in pain and grief, to see it and to let up, not to go with it, to stay here. You could say, well, what do I do? So I see it, so what? But that seeing, if it is real seeing, is here. It's not the thought realm. So it has that helping effect, if you will, of staying here and not going with the webbing of painful thinking and wanting and longing. This was a marvelous thing that happened, but it took a while. So those who are right now grieving over the loss of someone, be patient. Be patient. There's no need to run away from it, because in that staying here, there is immense learning and a wonderful opportunity for wisdom to unfold about what is happening. And that ultimately is the essence of a religious mind. You see, I didn't approach this theologically or philosophically or whichever way it was, with the energy gathering and being with what was there. Not running away or wallowing. Although in the beginning there was that. And to see that and to see the effects of it, to learn as we go. That, to me, is the essence of a religious mind, not ideas about things or dogma or thought work, but the directness of seeing and discovering, and also discovering that amazing effect of discovery. I don't even want to say effect, because there's no time in between. Discovery is lightness, brightness, and joy, even if it's discovering something very painful. This light of discovery overruns, outweighs what it is that is seen. So to also be very critical, if you will, not condemning or negative, but critical, by that I mean astutely watching when the grief arises or the tears come, to ask oneself, what is motivating this? What is at the base of it? And traditionally, for millennia, there is at the root of it also the fact that grief and loss need to be cried over, the story of it. And to see that happening in oneself and wonder whether that has a real basis for existence, being crying because of sentimentality. This is not said judgmentally. I could see it in myself. We cry and take our crying very seriously and never wonder what brings the tears. And maybe there is nothing except the grief. But maybe there is also the seeing oneself as somebody who has lost someone, sort of this image-making in process, which stirs the tear glands and the chest here. I'm not saying it is so. It is for us to discover, and when this is discovered, it may not be so hard to let go of or to subside. Not to deceive oneself. And what was described before, this disrupted energy field with someone one has shared life together, in all its aspects, that rupture of it, does have a way of healing. If there is wisdom unfolding about the grieving and the pain and not being totally lost in that, but still open to whatever else is going on, including the beauty of a blue or clouded sky, the trees and grasses and creatures, even the tiny little ones that we so easily step on. So, to be patient. And one thing that person mentioned, that has been mentioned to me many times, is that there's not only grief and sadness, there's also anger coming up. Anger at one's fate. Anger at having been left abandoned by that person, by that beloved. When I first heard this years ago, somebody telling me this, how she was so angry at her husband for having left her, I couldn't believe it. How was that possible? But I had hints of it. Not very much, I will say, but there were hints of it at times Why did he leave me? Couldn't he have stayed around? Sort of these irrational thoughts which create emotions. So when they come up, don't suppress it. But hold it there to be seen, to be plumbed and understood, not condemned and not wallowing in it. This is apparently a very natural phenomenon, this anger at being feeling abandoned, because we all had that experience very early in life. The mother was not always there when we needed her, or whoever was the caregiver. So, abandonment is one of our earliest imprints, or the fear of it, the fear of loss of love and comfort, warmth, affection. And these early wounds are deeply stirred again with a present loss. So, let me just tell that last short chapter of this grieving period in my life. When I was in Sesshin, in retreat, every night I went by the telephone, I would take it upstairs, and then when I was in bed, I would call Kyle, usually for the fifth time a day. It was not just then. And we would talk, and he wasn't very sick yet. When he was very sick, then a friend of ours stayed with him while I was here in retreat. So here, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years later, in a retreat, I walk by the phone, and there was almost the reflex, the old reflex, to pick it up and take it upstairs. And the joyful realization that I didn't have to worry anymore about Kyle. I didn't have to worry about him, and I didn't have to take care of him anymore, which had been quite a task. Not very long. Many people have much longer periods of illness. And it was an incredible relief and feeling of freedom that I had never, ever in my life experienced before. And also from then on, it was possible to have pleasant, joyful memories of our time together. Whereas before, when people would say to me, "Well, you still have your memories," I thought, these memories are no fun. They're pain. And now this had changed. And there was no desire of filling the hole, the gap, with someone else. It was such a deeply fulfilling thing to live alone, which I'd never expected, because I'd never lived alone before. So, to be patient, to be observant, to let that energy, at least at times, particularly in retreat, gather, to be here and let become bright and clear what is stirring this human heart. Not run away from it, not shy away from it, but let it be there and show itself and be gracefully, graciously perceived as possible. particularly when you are engaged in this work, but that's not a total necessity for it. It happens also without that, I could imagine. We still have a group in the afternoon. If you have unanswered questions or need something to talk off your chest, well, there will be an opportunity. But let me try. I have this favorite ending poem from Mary Oliver. I got a new book given to me, a new Mary Oliver. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to read it yet, but the time will come. And this one is called The Sun. Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful than the way the sun every evening, relaxed and easy, floats toward the horizon and into the clouds or the hills or the rumpled sea? And it's gone. And how it slides again out of the blackness every morning on the other side of the world, like a red flower streaming upward on its heavenly oils, say, on a morning in early summer at its perfect imperial distance. And have you ever felt for anything such wild love? Do you think there is anywhere in any language a word billowing enough for the pleasure that fills you as the sun reaches out, as it warms you, and you stand there empty-handed? Or have you too turned from this world? Or have you too gone crazy for power? For things? We will end here for today.